From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the digital revolution, the language is binary code, zeros and ones. In the life science revolution, the language is genetics-based. The biotech industry more than doubled in size between 1993 and 1999. The following clip is from a Biotech Trade Association's new TV ad entitled DNA.
DNA. Our genes connect us all.
We are researchers in the science of biotechnology.
It's our common dedication.
Discovering a new path.
Discovering a new path.
To health.
To health.
Understanding how our bodies work.
Understanding how our bodies work.
We're already
work.
Helping people around the world.
Fight diseases like cancer, diabetes, cystic fibrosis.
Biotechnology, our new scientific link to health.
That was an ad for the Biotechnology Industry Organization, a trade association for the biotech industry. The promise of the genomic revolution is that it will change the world. It's fundamentally altering the way doctors diagnose their patients and the definition of preventable disease. But the revolution extends beyond the biotech bubble, says Harvard Business Professor Juan Enriquez. It's working its way into almost every aspect of human life. Societies that understand the genetic alphabet will get richer, says our guest tonight, while countries that are scientifically illiterate will soon fall dramatically farther behind. The genomic revolution, the biotech revolution, is changing business and life in the United States and around the world. Are you ready for the revolution? Joining me now is Juan Enriquez, director of the Life Science Project at Harvard Business School. He's the author of As the Future Catches You, How Genomics and Other Forces Are Changing Your Life, Work, Health, and Wealth. Good evening and welcome, Juan Enriquez.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Juan Enriquez, paint the big picture for us, and you're going to have to be doubly persuasive because, of course, we all just came through the Internet boom where we heard all this language about how great things were coming. And, of course, a lot is changing, but there's also been a lot of talk about boom and bust in that world. What's coming in the biotech revolution? Is it on a par with the Internet? Is it on a par with computers? Is it on a par with steam engines and the Industrial Revolution? What do you see? What's the vista looking ahead?
I think there's been nothing that mankind has ever been able to come up with that's as powerful as this, because we're beginning to understand the language of life. And all life, viruses, bacteria, plants, animals, ourselves, are coded in the same language, which is DNA. And once you can code DNA, and let me stress that this is very new, the ability to read life code started in 1995 with a very small bacteria, and it culminated last year with the first plant, the first fruit fly, and the first human.
Mm-hmm.
And once you can start reading these things, then you can start understanding, and we're not there yet, but you can start understanding how different life forms are coded. That's going to tell us why some people get sick and others don't, why some people react to a medicine in a bad way and others don't, why some people are taller and shorter, and a whole series of things about ourselves. We're beginning to learn about a map was as important as the map that Columbus drew or started to draw in 1492.
Well, and you cite that. You say that this decoding of the genome, the human genome and others, is much like 1492. People eventually, maybe months or years later, learned that it happened, but it took years, decades, centuries for people to really understand the significance. You say that we are, in the same way as Columbus was, approaching a new continent.
Yes. You know, Columbus died and there wasn't even a portrait done of him. He wasn't considered important enough to have a portrait done until after his death. The first printed maps of the Americas were discovered by Columbus in 1492. The first printed maps weren't out till about 1506. The fact that the maps took a long time, that they were wrong, doesn't mean the world didn't fundamentally change. And the same thing is happening now. It's a really exciting time to be alive.
I think a lot of people, when they think of biotech, they think of new medicine. And expect that medicine in the larger sense will become more and more effective. But you describe in your book a world of changes that go far beyond simply affecting human health. Give us a sense of the range of impact that you anticipate from the genomic revolution.
Well, you mentioned earlier the Internet changes or the digital changes, and there's a bunch of things that have gone away, like profits, like companies. But there's a bunch of things that are still there. You know, we're all on email now, and we've all got access to the web, and we've all got a different way of researching things, and there's a different way in which you set up businesses, and the amount of information that we absorb is different. Something very similar is happening with gene code, because it's not just when you go to your pharmacy. It's not just when you look at a biotech company. It's driving computers. It's driving food. It's driving energy. It's driving a whole series of businesses that are really large businesses in a very different direction at a much faster rate of speed than we would expect.
You say try an experiment, sit and look at an orange and a CD. And in the biotech era, you see a connection between the two, whereas most people see a packet of information and a piece of fruit. What's the connection?
Well, if you think of what's actually in a CD, if you take a blank CD and break it open, you're not going to read A, B, C, D. You're simply going to see strings of ones and zeros. If you were to look at it, say, a CD magnified 1,000 times, you'll see dot, dash, dot, dash. If you look at the inside of a seed, what you're going to see is four nucleotide base pairs that are adenine, thiamine, guanine, cytosine, and we know those as A, T, C, G. That was the inspiration for the title of the movie Gattaca, those four letters.
Mm-hmm.
And what that code is really telling the orange is when you drop to the ground, the first line of code, which would read A, A, T, C, A, G, G, A, C, C, would mean put out a root. The next line of code, T-A-C-C-C-A-G-G-G, would say make a stem, make a flower that looks like this, make it white, make it bloom in the spring. And once we can read that code and once we can understand that code, then we can change the function of that orange in the same way as we can change a CD when we email it or when we write on it or when we put a piece of music.
Change the function in what way? To put down two roots? To put down two blossoms?
Well, if you go to the Harvard Medical School, one of the things that somebody like Cliff Tabin is working on is he's working on chickens that are growing five wings. And why would you want a chicken with five wings if you don't own a restaurant? Well, one of the reasons why you might want it is because when a lizard loses its tail, the tail regrows on the lizard. When a human being loses a leg or an arm or a big chunk of skin, it doesn't regrow. So one of the things that is really exciting about this stuff is we're probably going to learn how to regrow a significant amount of our body parts, our pancreas, the back of our eyes, skin, bone. And in the measure that we understand this code, we're also going to be able to reprogram oranges so that they produce things like vaccines. That's been done. So you've got bananas that can now vaccinate you against cholera when you eat them. Or you can create corn that creates a synthetic fiber that is polyester but feels like silk. So it's going to change the nature of material science. It's going to change the nature of medicine production. It's going to change the nature of energy.
Jack Beattie, we're talking here about regrowing human organs, about oranges serving as little pharmaceutical factories. This does sound like a new world.
Yeah, and it's quite beyond me. I can't get to the ABCs of it. You know, when you look at the last high-tech revolution, what's striking is the role government played in encouraging it. I mean, it's almost unthinkable without the military-industrial complex spurred by Cold War priorities funding basic high-tech research. But I'm wondering about the role of government in this new revolution. You know, when you read about the president's stem cell decision, the cloning decision, you wonder to what degree the government, our own policy, will give other nations a comparative advantage in the biotech revolution because they won't have our political restrictions on scientific research. I wonder if Professor Enriquez could speak to that.
I think that's a really important subject because what you're dealing with, if this starts driving the global economy, it is absolutely essential that U.S. research and researchers stay on the forefront of this if you're going to build and maintain economic wealth as the U.S. has been doing for many years. You had a shift from Western Europe being a dominant nation to the U.S. and parts of Asia being dominant nations because the U.S. and parts of Asia understood the shift to a computer, digital, software-driven economy. And a lot of Western Europe missed that. There are nations right now that are very deliberately targeting U.S. researchers like Britain or like China or like Singapore that would love to have the biotech base the U.S. has. And they're going to compete and try and drag away some of the world's best brains.
You write about a lot of impacts that this revolution will have on economies within nations and between nations. Listeners, are you ready for this, for the bio revolution? Are you ready for mankind to control life itself with all that means? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Juan Enriquez, you say that this entire movement toward genetics developing a huge new industry or industries will increase the disparities between the wealth of nations and between rich and poor within nations. Why is that?
Well, it used to be that if a government really screwed up for 100 years and it was an agricultural economy, there was always a reason to go back to the country and retake the fields and regrow the farm. In an industrial world, after about 30 years, that factory was worthless. So a lot of people didn't go back to Eastern Europe to take over those facilities. They stayed where they were working. In a knowledge economy, once a brain moves, once a lab moves, it's very hard to see a reason to go back to Argentina, where you used to have an awful lot of Nobel Prize winners, but you don't have them anymore. And you're getting a concentration of wealth and brains in a very few places. IBM last year produced more U.S. patents than 139 countries of this world did together. Why was it doing it? Well, IBM's a good company, and it's an interesting place to work for people who are on the leading edge of molecular science, of software, of biotech. So it tends to be the self-reinforcing spiral where smart people, they don't need a lot of land. They don't need big facilities. They need to be sitting in a network of other smart people, and they tend to concentrate.
What are those concentrations within the United States, for starters, and what will that mean for areas that are not within the bio-revolution sphere?
Well, there's four sort of odd areas. There's the Republic of Torrey Pines, which is one single road along Torrey Pines Road in San Diego. Mm-hmm. That's quite a beautiful spot. And then you've got the Empire of NIH that's sitting outside of Rockville, Maryland, funded by the U.S. government and a lot of the research. Then you've got the Boston-Cambridge 02138 opinionated zip code area. That's very powerful because it's got BU and it's got MIT and it's got Harvard, and it's got, you know, 35 colleges and universities feeding into this thing. And then you've got Silicon Valley that's got some really smart people. University of California as a whole was the single largest producer of biotech patents in the world last year. That's more than any pharmaceutical, more than any biotech. I mean, this is where a lot of the stuff is coming out of.
Will these four areas spin off new wealth for the entire United States, or is this going to be regionally concentrated wealth?
That's a really important question for the United States. There's a lot of states, Research Triangle, North Carolina, or Georgia, or a series of places that would give their right arm to have what these four places have in terms of university development and company development. They're investing a lot of time and money trying to get that. I hope that they get a piece of this thing, because the more concentrated these things become, the more of a division you get. And one of the trends that you see in the world is the world is splitting up into smaller and smaller nations. About three-quarters of the countries outside the UN today on those flags were not there 50 years ago. And the really interesting thing is it's not the ethnically conflictive and poor areas that are splitting off. It's the rich areas that are saying, we don't need the rest of you guys.
And to Jack Beatty's point, there have been and continue to be very hot moral debates within the U.S. about how far the country and its industries and scientific establishment should go in genetic science. Do you see that as a real impediment now to playing in this world? Does the country have to choose between morality and success in this era?
Well, I think Jack's point is right on target, because government policy and government funding of basic research really does matter. And these are issues that can split the Republican Party right down the middle. You know, there are very few issues in U.S. history that you sort of say these are issues that are big enough and important enough that they can lead to a political realignment. But you've got half of the Republican Party that's pro-business, pro-research, pro-science, that's just charging ahead on these things. And you've got another part of the Republican Party that thinks that evolution is still a theory, that is opposed to stem cell research, that is very strong in its feelings that this shouldn't happen. Those feelings are strong enough that they can lead to some really complicated political maneuvering.
Do they already constitute a drag on American progress in the genomics revolution as you have it?
I don't think the latest stem cell decisions by Bush are terminal. I think if you start to prove the value of stem cells and you start finding that you really do need new stem cell lines and you stop them, that will lead to some really serious consequences. If you continue substituting private research by government-funded research on a massive scale, that could lead to a series of businesses getting in trouble.
We're talking about a biotech revolution, about a genomics revolution. Listeners, are you ready for this? Are you ready for mankind to control life itself? With all that means, can you picture a world infused with genomics, a world where DNA itself is a widget, is a business? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a new era breaking open on the back of breakthroughs in genomics, in biotechnology, changing everything from the way we do ordinary physical activities to the way we interact with one another to the way our industries work around the world. Are you ready for this? Are you ready for the bio revolution? Are you ready for mankind to control life itself with all that means? Our guest tonight is Juan Enriquez. He's director of the Life Science Project at the Harvard Business School and author of As the Future Catches You, How Genomics and Other Forces Are Changing Your Life, Work, Health, and Wealth. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You can join us. Juan Enriquez, you're very clear that knowledge attracts knowledge, that wealth properly applied is going to attract wealth here. How does this feed into the conflicts we already see between rich and poor here? Is the very texture of human life going to be different, in even more different, in rich and poor countries than it is today? And is that going to create new geopolitical tensions along the genomic revolution path?
Well, you're beginning to already see this in a pretty stark way. In an agricultural society, the difference between what you and I might produce in a different country, in the richest country and the poorest country, is about 5 to 1. So if you had a better cow and you had a little bit more land, you had a few more kids, you could produce about 5 times more wealth than I can or could. Today, the difference is about 427 to 1. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon, it's going to be about 1,000 to 1. And the reason why this difference is increasing is because, again, you don't need a lot of land. You don't need a lot of wealth. You don't need a lot of people. That's why people in Luxembourg today produce about 30% more wealth every year than do Americans. Luxembourg is
individual, each per capita, you mean?
Per capita. Mm-hmm. So Luxembourg actually turns out to be the richest country in the world in terms of what each person produces, mm-hmm. not the U.S. You're going to see this a lot more. You're going to see a bunch of little states that tend to do very well, that come out of nothing. Singapore in 1965 was not considered a viable nation state. And now it's one of the richest nations in Southeast Asia and has a decent European-like standard of living. You're going to see an awful lot of this happening where smart people come together into little clusters. Now, what worries me is that there's a series of groups like Latinos, like Hispanics, like folks in Latin America, like African Americans, and like Africans who are spending a lot of time on things that are really important, like history and law and literature and art and poetry, all of which are essential to maintaining a culture, but you don't see a lot of science coming out of there, and you don't see a lot of debate about science. And in fact, about 27% of the PhDs in the U.S. are going to Asian or Asian Americans, about 2% are going to African Americans, about 1% are going to Hispanics and Latin Americans. And if this is the way you generate wealth, those divisions are going to grow if those groups don't start paying a lot of attention to how you generate wealth and learn these languages.
Mm. Jack Petey, here's a new horizon to get all our attention. Juan Enriquez is describing incredible developments that will come out of this new biological biotech revolution. At the same time, new and dramatic stresses on populations within and between nations.
Yeah, the whole situation of the knowledge worker and in the knowledge society. I mean, on the one hand, it promises the chance to really change the human condition. That at some point, robots or the merger of biotech and high tech are going to do most of the heavy work. And already, much of the onerous work that people used to do is done by machines. So that's all to the good. But on the other side, it's going to mean many fewer people employed, presumably, because what we've just seen, perhaps Professor Enriquez can talk about this, is these industries, this biotech industry manages to get the GDP of whole countries within a single company with only a handful of employees. And I'm terribly afraid that in this new society, we're going to have a lot of certain, not only people who are left out of the sort of sweepstakes of the biotech companies, but who are going to be really kind of left out of everything, that the place of work in that society and what people are going to do, that this is a problem that we really haven't thought through, sort of that puts, to me, the knowledge society, otherwise devoutly to be wished for, in a kind of bracket of doubt.
Juan Enriquez, what do you think? Can we have both a system in which knowledge wielded by a few creates enormous wealth and a system in which large populations can be, you know, well taken care of, can live together productively and harmoniously?
Well, I think the U.S. has to be an example of that, because what we've been seeing is nation after nation splitting apart and talking about, you know, let's have a separate Quebec and let's have a separate Northern Italy and let's have a separate Scotland and let's have a separate Catalonia and Basque region. One of the things that I think the U.S. has to concentrate on is making sure that people don't get left behind. And the way you do that is by making them science literate, because I agree that if you have a situation where a big chunk of the society doesn't understand it, they don't have to be computer programmers, but they've got to understand what a computer can do. They've got to understand why a personal digital assistant, fancy word for a BlackBerry or a Palm or something like that, or very soon a cell phone, has as much computer power as the Apollo 11 lunar landing module. And when you've got that kind of power in your hands, you better understand what that means and how you can use it and how you can communicate with different places. You better be a part of a network.
And yet we know that many people, even in the United States, are not. You say in your book that there are millions, and many of them live in penitentiaries already, who aren't equipped with this knowledge and therefore, you know, turn to desperate paths to try and make a go of it. Let's turn to the phones. Mary's on the line. Welcome, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a couple of points that actually speak to what your guests have just been talking about. Mm-hmm. I actually have cut up DNA and put it back together for a living. I'm a trained basic scientist.
Okay, so you're in the groove.
I'm in the groove. So I don't have any moral or ethical issues with what can be done with genetic science. What I'm worried about are things that speak to, for example, what was spoken of about people being left behind, or this idea of the concentration of benefit to just a few people in a biotech firm. It's worse, I think, than that. It's the concentration of benefit to, say, agribusinesses. If you've got a case where you can grow tobacco that makes antibiotics or makes vaccines, you can save a family farmer who's being put out of business because we're trying to get people to stop smoking.
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep this out of control of the Monsantos of the world and still support smaller agribusiness, smaller family farms, and yet reap the benefits of the technology that's coming out?
Mary, why can't it work the other way? Microsoft has made a lot of money from computers, but small family farmers also use computers to themselves be more productive.
Well, it can work that way if, well, it's a perfect example. Why is Microsoft in an antitrust lawsuit right now?
Mm-hmm.
Monsanto has done similar things with seeds. Or, you know, you get Roundup Ready soybeans, the only way you can grow that is if you buy their particular herbicide. And that, I think, is a little tangential to the point that I want to make and think I have made.
Mm-hmm. Mary, we got it. Let me put it to Juan Enriquez. What about it? Is there a way that this explosion of new knowledge can be kept in many hands and not in a few corporate hands?
I think one of the things that you're going to see is an enormous explosion of new companies. I mean, before Microsoft was there, the company that the U.S. Justice Department was most afraid of in the 1970s that thought was going to dominate all U.S. business and all U.S. knowledge was Xerox. And, of course, Xerox today is fighting for its survival. And you get these technology cycles that are so fast, and there's so many companies running in so many different ways to come up with new seeds, to come up with new technologies, that I think it's not one company that we have to be afraid of. It's not educating broad groups of the population that we have to be afraid of.
You're saying there will be lots of new companies that will horn in here, even at the expense of large companies?
As long as we continue educating the population. One thing that really worries me about the U.S. is instead of generating and paying attention to science and generating more people like Mary, we're importing a lot of brains. We've got a lot of graduate students who are coming from other places that are some of the world's best brains.
Is this a plus or a minus?
Well, it's an enormous plus for the United States. Mm-hmm. I mean, the U.S. economy is powered by these brains. They say that Silicon Valley is powered by ICs, and that's not integrated circuits. That's Indians and Chinese, because that's where a lot of this brain power is coming from. That's a loss for China, and that's one of the reasons why China has to pay attention to human rights, because the single most important thing China has is those brains, and that's what's going to generate its wealth.
Juan Enriquez, take us back down to some of the developments that you say are going to come out of this revolution. Talk to us about biocomputing. What is that? How does nanotechnology come in here? Walk us through some of the what you describe as sort of amazing tech developments that you expect to come from the genome arena.
Well, the really exciting thing, I mean, the thing that's just fascinating is you really don't know what you're going to read when you open up a science magazine or when you open up a Nature magazine or when you open up, the science section of a newspaper or the front pages of a newspaper, because very few people in the science community went and predicted that Dolly would be cloned before it happened. And so you're seeing a whole series of things in this world that just appear and seem to appear out of nowhere. Biotech's a very small part of it. There's a whole ability to design and build things on a molecular scale that's going to be as important as the digital revolution.
And this will come out of genomics?
Well, genomics is a part of it, but it's the ability to manipulate single atoms. It's the ability to create machines on a nanoscale, which is building things on a billionth of an inch scale.
Will these be organic things being built?
Well, that's a really
living things?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, we don't know if computers in 10 years will be organic, because each of our cells contains our entire gene code. In the time period that you and I are talking, we're probably going to create our entire gene code a billion times over in each of our cells as our cells die off and reproduce.
So you're saying that organic creatures, organisms, could be computers in a sense as we know them today?
We're beginning to see some people experimenting with DNA and increasing DNA to solve some really complicated problems like traveling salesman problems. We're beginning to see software designers create Darwinian computer programs where you simply throw a lot of power at these things, and every generation, whatever solves the problem faster, that's the program that survives. We're beginning
that's
to
the
see
traveling salesman problem?
That's one of the applications that you can have in this.
But okay.
At Stanford, for instance, they're beginning to wire earthworm brains to computer chips. And Jim Clark, who founded Netscape, gave a lot of money there to create biological computers. This stuff is farther in the future than some of the stuff we were talking about, but it's really exciting stuff.
Jack Beatty, are you ready to bring an earthworm into your hard disk there?
Well, you know, it's this very fusion between biotech and high tech that brought Bill Joy, the chief scientist of Sun Microsystems, to write a really important article a few years ago in Wired, and it was called Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. And basically, he was saying he was scared. He was scared. Well, and the reason he was scared, he quoted an authority on this, and he said this is one of the reasons he was scared. He said the authority writes, first, let us postulate that computer scientists succeed in developing intelligent machines that can do all the things we do but better. In that case, all the work will be done by vast, highly organized systems of machine, and no human effort will be necessary. Either of two cases might occur. The machines might be permitted to make all their own decisions, or else human control over the machines might be retained. Well, he goes on to say that if human control is maintained, it may be maintained in a very few hands, people who know the various languages. And, of course, this is the political fear of a kind of Aldous Huxley. You know, in the 20th century, we're worried about 1984, totalitarianism. Mm-hmm. It may well be that Brave New World of, you know, the medicated person, the person whose dignity has been sort of, got round by nanobots, by tiny little things implanted in him. Of course, the author of these lines was Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. And when you find yourself nodding your head reading that, you think, wait a minute, this guy was a nut. How crazy is he when you start contemplating this notion of the revolution of the tiny, how these little tiny things inside us can begin to direct human activity. You know, the director of President Bush's Science Council on Biotech Research is called Leon Cass. He's at the University of Chicago. He wrote an article some years ago called The Wisdom of Repugnance, that just in our the repugnance we have, listening to things like that, there is a kind of wisdom. And although I think he goes too far, I think his caution is well taken. We need to take counsel with that repugnance and to figure out where it could go.
An element of repugnance, and yet the new is always frightening, and the new has brought us a lot that's good as well. Let's turn to the phones. Jack is on the line. Welcome, Jack. You're on the air.
Yes. Unfortunately, your guest comments contain a certain amount of hyperbole that's more characteristic of a salesman than an analyst.
Talk to us, Jack. What's your perspective?
At one point, he said, well, now we're on this great threshold because we understand the genome of a couple of organisms and we've read the DNA. Well, the scroll of the DNA is not even half the book. Your guest said, well, the DNA says to a plant, well, here's how to put a root down, or whatever the quote was. I don't recollect it exactly.
Yep.
That's not what the DNA says. The DNA says, this is how you code this protein, this is how you code that protein, this is how you code that protein.
Jack, do you mean by this that these changes are farther off than we're suggesting tonight?
What I'm saying is that when this whole phenomenon and this whole biotechnology is explained to the public, it's being explained to them now with, as I said, salesman tactics, the tactics of a huckster, the tactics of the great biotech gold rush. There is a vast gulf between even knowing the DNA of the human genome and knowing the next level that you don't even hear about, which is that it codes for a lot of proteins whose interactions are so complicated that even getting through all that part about how the proteins interact is a whole nother ocean beyond the tiny little pond of being able to read that DNA.
Jack, it's a big point. Let me put it to Juan Enriquez and stand by. Juan, what about it? Are we still oceans away from the kind of future we're talking about here tonight?
Yeah, I agree with Jack. I mean, I think we're just beginning to understand this stuff. And I think I made the point that in 1492, when Columbus discovered the Americas, what he had was the map of a very small island, and that the maps of 1506 were the first printed maps, and that the maps of 1556 still had India above where the Arctic Circle is.
Does that suggest that these are issues for our great-great-grandchildren and not for us?
No. The fact that the maps were wrong, the fact that they were inaccurate, the fact that they didn't map in detail the mountains or the lakes or the inner part of continents doesn't mean that the balance of power didn't start to shift in a fundamental way, that Spain became a very different nation, that Europe became a very different place because Columbus found a place that he didn't understand what he'd found and didn't understand a place that he knew what it meant.
Good caller, Jack. What do you think? Are we right to be considering the implications of this even though it's early days?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I just want to comment on his analogy. Let's stick to the analogy of Columbus. The point is, Columbus, what came after Columbus? A whole bunch of Spaniards that came in decided we'll kill all the Indians in the Americas.
Now you're losing me with the analogy. What do you mean by that, Jeff?
The analogy is this. Exactly back to what I said before about mischaracterizing the science and technology to the public at large. A few years ago, it's already many years ago, they said, well, we're going to take a fish gene and stick it in a tomato because then the tomato won't rot. This is not just crossbreeding. This is taking from a whole different order of creature, and a different kingdom of creature, and sticking, you know, from animals into plants.
Jack, we're almost out of time, but I just want to understand. Are you saying that this is further off than we're suggesting, or that you don't want it to happen?
No, I'm saying that I'll close with saying that my implication that there's a certain amount of hyperbole, salesmanship, and hucksterism for the benefit of business. The point of all of that is we're neglecting the fundamental social and aspects of what we're doing, and that we need a more critical approach that's not subservient to the business ends of a new technology.
Jack, we've got your point, and we thank you for it. We're talking about the biotechnology revolution. Fast or slow, it is emerging. Biotech workers, what changes do you foresee? What are you cooking up right now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Our guest tonight is Juan Enriquez. We're talking with him about the biotechnology revolution, the genomics revolution. He's director of the Life Science Project at Harvard Business School and author of As the Future Catches You, How Genomics and Other Forces Are Changing Your Life, Work, Health, and wealth. Juan Enriquez, we had caller Jack just before the break saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, when you describe these grand vistas of what's coming, what will or may happen, there's a danger of sliding into hucksterism here that focuses the debate on business opportunities, he would say, or fear, at the expense of a profound consideration of social issues, of issues of basic humanity.
I think there's two different issues here. One is, should I take my savings and invest them next quarter in biotech firms? And my answer there would, no, don't do that. A lot of the quarter-to-quarter results of firms and a lot of the companies that start out in the biotech revolution are not companies that are going to succeed. And you see this over and over again if you look at the railroad revolution. Most of the companies that started railroads ended up dead. Most of the companies that started cars ended up dead. More recently, if you'd started programming on an Altair computer like Gates did, you know, you wouldn't have wanted to buy Altair stock or
but Jack's point goes even further, doesn't he? He's saying, look, we just came through a decade that was full of a kind of hucksterism, and a lot of people got burned, as you're suggesting, on short-term stock bets. But on a larger scale, that very focus or fervor around business opportunities pulls the mind away from what are potentially even deeper long-term issues.
Well, I think there are fundamental long-term issues. I think there are issues of how we're going to manage war. There are issues of how we're going to manage poverty. There are issues of how politics are going to change, about how we're going to feed and what we want to eat, about how long we want to live. These are all issues that are being brought up by having potentially the power to do things that we've never understood before. Somebody mentioned earlier the yuck factor. Should you do stuff that makes you feel yucky? Well, I think the yuck factor tends to change. I think very few people would have agreed to test tube babies. And now a lot of families see in vitro fertilization as a blessing. I think a
lot. So our notions of what's repugnant change over time. Some of those changes, I guess, we end up being grateful for, and some perhaps we don't. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, John. You're on.
Hi. Yeah, I wonder, could your guest discuss the evidence that biotech shows no cost or time to market benefit compared to big pharma?
So you're saying that biotechnology doesn't help produce pharmaceuticals more effectively than big pharmaceutical companies did?
That's the evidence that biotech companies worry about.
There's a worrying one for those quarterly reports. Juan Enriquez?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. If you look at the investment in biotechnology as a whole, the net economic return has been negative. On the other hand, if you look at what pharmaceutical companies have been investing in, big pharma's been buying up an awful lot of these biotech companies. And one of the ways in which they've been feeding their pipeline has been this. I think one of the things the U.S. should be worried about is the productivity coming out of massive amounts of research isn't close to what it should be. And that's something we've got to sort of sit back and rethink about, because we should be getting more benefits out of this investment.
Elizabeth is on the line. Welcome, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
This is a fascinating discussion, and I think that one of your panelists referred earlier to what I think is the larger implication of the caller who commented on hucksterism, which is the sweep of technology in our lives since, if you just arbitrarily measure it, since Columbus arrived in the New World. Mm-hmm. Our record of judging the long-term effect of our technology decisions on our species and other species and the planet is really not good. Columbus's arrival resulted in the decimation of native populations, etc. And we really, I'd like to ask your panelists, what do you see as the best method for injecting or ensuring we ensure in the scientific debate, mm-hmm. the kinds of values discussions that will lead to our very broad and deep technological power being used to create a more sustainable planet, more equity for people.
Elizabeth, I think we've got it, and our time is running down. Let me put that to Juan Enriquez quickly, Juan Enriquez, because our time is going. How do we keep this deep sense of values alive? How do we make sure, or take our best shot at making sure, that this gives us ultimately a better planet, a better life?
Well, one of the things that I'm trying to do with this book is to take things that are very complicated and bring them into the public debate. Because I think one of the ways in which you ensure this is to have a whole series of people who are non-scientists, who are not necessarily aware of how fast this is moving, and bring them into the debate and teach them why this is important for their kids to understand in schools, why it's important for them to understand what they're voting on. These are things that we all have to participate in as a society because they do lead to fundamental changes in what we're going to do with the planet.
It sounds like there's not an easy answer there, except, again, it comes back to education at some level so that we understand what's going on. But even then, we hear Elizabeth's concern and fear. Juan Enriquez, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. Juan Enriquez is author of As the Future Catches You, How Genomics and Other Forces Are Changing Your Life, Work, Health, and Wealth. Jack Beatty, you can hear in that last call the sort of awe at what's possible here and the fear of where it may ultimately take the human race.
Yeah, Elizabeth's point is so well taken. And Archibald MacLeish, the author of JJB, wrote years ago, "Information without understanding leads to Hiroshima." And there's the lag, isn't it? We have all the information and science and technology, but our moral equipment and our imaginative equipment is doesn't know progress. And, in fact, it can even know the opposite. So
and yet
there's a race going on between values and knowledge.
Yet, as Juan Enriquez says in his book, technology is not kind. It does not say please. And if the United States doesn't develop this, somebody else will.
Sheesh. I think that's right.
For more information about the genomic revolution, log on to our website at onpointradio.org. Up next, getting a grip on the money behind March Madness. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to On Point. In just a few minutes, Maryland and Indiana tip off for the National Collegiate Basketball Championship. Over the past few weeks, March Madness, with all its fanfare and frenzy, has swept the nation. Along with huge fan interest and sky-high slam dunks comes the perennial and growing controversy over academics, sports, and dollars. Tom McMillan was an All-American basketball player for the University of Maryland in the 1970s. He was a Rhodes Scholar who went on to play pro ball with the New York Knicks. Later, he became a U.S. congressman and was co-chair of President Clinton's Council on Physical Fitness and Sports. Now, he's calling for reform in the NCAA. I asked him what needs to change.
Well, the root problem is the ever-increasing commercialization in college sports. You know, coaches making more money, bigger stadiums, more cost pressures, and it's a race to keep up with the Joneses, and I think it's, in many respects, an arms race that is bankrupting a lot of institutions of higher learning in this country.
Now, from the outside, looking in, it's an awfully great show. Everybody's enthusiastic, getting the popcorn in right now, ready to watch the game tonight.
Well, I'm not opposed to college sports. I think college sports is a great spectacle. What I think we need to do is look at where the money's going and try to correct where the revenues are being distributed so that we are incenting the right behavior, incenting more academic behavior and less commercial behavior. I think that kids will play just as hard. The fans will like it just as much. It doesn't have to, you know, be the demise of college sports if you try to bring it more in consonant with college educational values.
How would you go about doing that, Tom McMillan?
Well, when I was in Congress, I submitted legislation 10 years ago that's pretty much on par with my feelings today after serving on the Knight Commission and watching this. First of all, in 1984, when the NCAA lost its monopoly in a Supreme Court decision on their television rights, Whizzer White, who was a Rhodes Scholar, dissented and said this would lead to an arms race because other schools would try to keep up with each other, and it would lead to escalating costs and more commercialization. And he was right.
That would be Justice Whizzer White.
Justice Whizzer White. Justice Whizzer White.
But this was a dissenting opinion. You think it's time to take a second look at that and bring back that view?
Well, because I think that in many respects you need a monopoly because the conferences are chasing dollars. I mean, all these schools can go out and sign their own television contracts. There's really no controls. And what the NCAA is only part of it because they only control the postseason tournaments and so forth. But all these dollars are being poured into the system, and there's really, truly an arms race going on. What happens is that the kids are being left behind. They're playing more and more Sunday night games. I was a chemistry major. major, I could not have graduated as a chemistry major with the games and the odd times that they're being forced to play. The networks and television are really controlling college sports. It's the presidents who should be controlling their own universities, and that's just not the case in college sports today. And it really is the athletic commercial tail wagging the academic dog.
So you're saying, let's intervene here. You're calling on Congress, on the president to intervene to give the NCAA the same kind of exemption that baseball has from antitrust regulation so that all the TV money would come to one central organization. How would that help fix the problem?
Because that would be like the United States Olympic Committee when it was reconstituted in 1970s. They are all powerful because now Congress can say, okay, well, you're going to have to bring coaches' salaries in line. Well, that means you can't have 40-plus coaches making $1 million because if you go down that slippery slope, the players are eventually going to sue and they're going to demand that they have a lawyer when they go in and talk to the athletic director and that they get paid. And I think they're going to win that case. And then all of a sudden the women will pitch in and say, wait a minute, Title IX says we should have parity in women's spending on sports spending on women's sports. And so you end up having the whole thing blow up because it's untenable to have a commercial and academic model coexist. And so my model basically gets it back all under one roof, and the money is distributed not for winning and losing, but it's distributed for the amount of programs you have, academic performance, counseling these young athletes, making sure that when they leave, that the one or two that go to the NBA aren't the only victors here, that everybody who goes through the college system is a winner in life. And unfortunately, that's not the case today. There are too many stories where schools have zero graduation rates. These kids are passing through the system, and most of them are being left behind.
Tom McMillan, I know you're going to be in Atlanta tonight watching Maryland as it plays Indiana. Are you looking forward to the game?
I certainly am. It's nice to have my alma mater in the Final Four.
When you look out, whether it's the game tonight or any college game these days, and you watch these incredible athletes on the floor and you think about them individually, what are your thoughts? What are your concerns for these young men?
When I look out there, I see a system that is really more chasing the almighty dollar than really trying to be a part and parcel of higher learning in this country. And, we live in a very competitive world. We spend billions of dollars on our colleges and universities, and we spend billions of dollars on our high schools. Well, we are compromising that in many respects by letting these circumstances exist on our campuses. And worse, our high schools are not immune from these pressures. Women are facing these kinds of pressures as they get into sports. High school athletes are facing these pressures. We are the only nation in the world that mixes school and sports so inextricably. And as a result of that, we end up and many times compromising our precious institutions of learning, which cannot be compromised in this country. You can have big-time sports, and you can have, education full of integrity, but you need balance, and balance is not the case right now.
But the current system is pretty deep in the grain at this point. If the system were changed, if the NCAA were giving an exemption from antitrust, if it controlled all the money, how long do you think it would take to change the current system, and how would it look? How would it be different 5 years from now?
Matter of fact, the fans wouldn't see a lot of difference. I'm all for 55,000 people coming to the game. I want that purse to go to giving more kids in college opportunities to play sports. I want kids to be counseled academically. I want to encourage a better educational value so that the experience is a fulfilling one for young people. I think kids will play just as hard, regardless of whether the money is going to 40 coaches who make $1 million a year or building bigger in stadiums. I don't think that really matters at the end of the day.
There's a call for reform right now. Maryland team and Indiana are both in the locker rooms or warming up. Tom McMillan, any message for the guys on your alma mater team, Maryland, tonight?
Well, it's one more game, and they obviously just have to go out there and play with basic fundamentals. I think they have a lot going for themselves, and so it'll be a great test, but also a great tribute for Maryland to win this thing.
Tom McMillan, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Tom McMillan is a former Maryland Terrapin basketball All-American and a three-term congressman from Maryland. He joined us from Atlanta. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is